Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. This is the first Legal Face-Off podcast since the Supreme Court decision in the immunity case of former President Donald Trump. Kimberly Whaley is a constitutional law expert, law professor at University of Baltimore. She's got a book out called Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. And I watched one of your YouTube videos, and I know you've got a lot of thoughts about this decision. Thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Great to be here.
Always good to have you back on. We've had now about a week to absorb this decision. Before we get into your thoughts, can you maybe explain these three different levels of immunity that the majority set forth?
Right. So the majority, first of all, established criminal immunity for presidents. That did not exist prior to this decision at all. And then it identified certain areas that they said are core and have absolute immunity, untouchable, things that are expressed in the Constitution, like the commander-in-chief power. So if the president's using the military, there's can't look into why. However the president uses the military, even to commit crimes, that is now immune from any kind of criminal review. The second level is what the court called the outer perimeter of official acts. So the gray area, something that's not expressed in the Constitution, but feels like it's the kind of thing that presidents need to have immunity for, that they will know it when they see it. And then there is, quote, unofficial acts. So for that, the first two parts where that are official or within the scope of official, that the court created a presumption of immunity, meaning the president gets the benefit of the doubt, and the government, if they wanted to collect information relating to official acts or prosecute, would have to overcome that presumption by showing that using that information would not somehow make it harder for the president to do his job or chill his ability to exercise his functions. The court did not give us any clear lines as to what's unofficial. It did say certain things are absolutely official, like talking to your Justice Department. But even with respect to January 6th and the horrors of January 6th, the majority didn't bring it on itself to say, okay, certain things like asking to have an election certified for yourself over your opponent, that the court was not willing to say it's unofficial.
So, Professor, with respect to that January 6th case, do you think that Jack Smith is going to be able to convince the judge that enough evidence remains to move forward in light of this decision?
Great question. I think the first step is, will there be internally? They're going to have to go through and get the Sharpie out and cross off the stuff that the Supreme Court kept out of the calculus, like talking to his acting attorney general, or said specifically talking to Mike Pence, vice president, and saying, don't certify the election. The court said that would be protected. And then the rest will go to Tanya Chutkin, who will then do that calculus, that analysis. I do think she's a former defense lawyer. She is, steely-eyed. I think they're in front of an excellent judge. But even if they get over those hurdles, the Supreme Court, this 6-3 majority, has left it on themselves to down the line disagree with whatever she rules on. So this is a huge win for Donald Trump. He gets every benefit of the doubt along the way. And it looks like this court's pretty biased in his favor. So even if they did get through these hurdles, I think there's not a small chance the court is going to reverse Judge Chutkin.
And even if all of that happens, Professor, is there any chance that happens in the really narrow window we have before the November election? And if not, all Trump does is disband the entire investigation and prosecution that Jack Smith is heading up, right? I mean,
there's no way this happens before
the election.
Zero. There's zero chance because the court said that this is a threshold decision. That is, you've got to make these decisions about official versus unofficial before you go to trial. So whatever she does will go right up on appeal. That takes months and months. It does not take weeks. It certainly doesn't take days. So that would never happen before November. They would never impanel a jury, have a trial. Absolutely impossible. It is dead for now, for 2024. That trial's dead.
So, Professor, how do you think the Fulton County RICO and New York hush money cases are affected by this decision?
Well, I think that Trump's lawyers already filed motions in those cases as well. He was president at the time that he, for example, asked the Secretary of State in Georgia to fraudulently, according to the government's theory, find fake votes in his favor. The Supreme Court said discussions with state officials may or may not be official. So, all of these remaining cases, and including really the one that's already he was convicted on, all of these cases now have to go through this ambiguous filter. And just so people are clear, the reason, this is a huge problem for the separation of powers is that it's not the unofficial stuff that the public and voters should be worried about. It's not whether he lies in a deposition about his divorce, for example, private activity. It's using public official power, the commander-in-chief power, the law enforcement power, prosecutorial power. It's abusing that power that is the threat to democracy. And that's the stuff the Supreme Court said is protected, meaning he can commit crimes using official power, and there's nothing that can be done about it even after a president's a private citizen.
Professor, how did we, it's an impossible question to answer, but how did we get to this point? Even a few months ago when this case was brought forth, it seemed like a layup. It seemed like the Supreme Court would summarily uphold the lower court's decision that a president is not above the law. A president doesn't enjoy such immunity. How do we get from that point to just a few months later, this decision? It didn't, to many of us, seem like it would be that complicated an issue. Yet here we are today with one of the most, one of the greatest expansions of executive power in history, if not the greatest.
You know, there's no way to look at it other than there are some biased or potentially corrupt justices on the Supreme Court. And I say that very soberly because, I wasn't one of the ones that thought it was a layup. The fact they accepted the case means they were going to do this. Professor Akhil Reed Amar, who's a constitutional giant from Yale Law School, went on MSNBC and publicly said the court declared the Constitution unconstitutional. The Constitution specifically says that even if somebody's impeached, they can be criminally indicted, prosecuted, and sentenced. So there's no way to square the decision that you can't be criminally indicted, prosecuted, and sentenced with the plain language of the Constitution itself. And these justices purport to be originalist, textualist. They literally read that out of the Constitution. The framers did foresee criminal liability for official acts. That is, you abuse your power, you're impeached, official acts, you can still be criminally indicted. So they, what's so disturbing about this is they really did change the structure of government itself in a way that's contrary to the plain language of the Constitution. So to answer your question, it's not legally defensible, and which makes you ask, okay, what's the rationale? And we know two of the justices, Thomas and Alito. Alito had stopped the seal flags on his lawns. Thomas's wife, Ginny, participated in the insurrection. And then you have three other justices in the majority, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Coney Barrett, were appointed by Donald Trump. And then you have the chief, Justice Roberts, which is, I think many people are disappointed that that he went with ideology and politics over the rule of law in this case.
Professor, before we let you go, tell us about your excellent new book, Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why, and particularly explain to us, if you can, whether Trump, if he is reelected president, will use the pardon power on himself.
Well, he's made really clear that he sees that he could pardon himself. He has promised to pardon the, over 1,000 insurrectionists, so he'd have his own private militia. The court suggested the pardon power does get criminal immunity. And I think the problem is this. Okay, so he gets immunity. How is he going to get the people in his office to go along with crimes, right? They don't get immunity. How they do that, how he would do that is promise a pardon. So the pardon is the shotgun in the closet that expands criminal immunity to other people within the executive branch that can exercise, follow up on orders to commit crimes. So the pardon power now, I think, has become much more of a liability for democracy than even before this immunity decision.
One quick follow-up on that. Does this protect, if Trump were to win, does this protect Biden from prosecution?
Great question. I mean, it should, but here again, this Supreme Court left open the door on what is official and unofficial. So if we're in kind of the gray area that it's not expressed in the Constitution and you can argue both ways, and I hope I'm incorrect, but this court is not being neutral in terms of the rule of law. You could see a situation where it's head, we win, Republicans win, tails, you lose, Democrats lose. So I don't, you know, he should be protected, but now essentially these six justices are the boss of the Constitution and the boss of criminal immunity and the boss of what presidents can and cannot do. And we won't know until that issue comes before them.
Professor Kimberly Whaley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Will AI deepfakes continue to target Hollywood, specifically celebrities? And we're chatting about that today with Rebecca Delfino. She wears a lot of hats at Loyola Marymount University. She's an associate dean and a professor of law with a focus on AI. Ms. Delfino, thanks for jumping on with us today.
Happy to be here. Professor, over the past year, we've had a number of guests on our show that have helped us discuss the rapidly evolving landscape of artificial intelligence and what I'd like to call the dark side of AI, like deepfakes, for example. And we keep hearing more about celebrity deepfakes, which have become increasingly pervasive over the past couple of years. What is it? Celebrity deepfakes that makes them different than deepfakes of non-celebrities?
Yeah, great question. So what makes celebrity deepfakes unique is what I call the immediate blast zone. So what do I mean by that? That means that celebrity deepfakes spread quickly and deeply and broadly in a way that boggles the mind. If you go back to February when the deepfake of Taylor Swift appeared on X, within a matter of hours, it had spread worldwide. And with ordinary people, or non-celebrities rather, they do spread, but not as quickly and not as profoundly in a way where they go viral.
So some of the celebrities that we are talking about that have been involved in lawsuits include some of the biggest names out there, Scarlett Johansson, Oprah Winfrey, Piers Morgan. How have they been dealing with these issues, and how does that influence the current deepfake landscape?
Yeah, so the way that typically a celebrity's concern, of course, is always about their brand and their ability to sort of market and maximize their image. And so one of the things that their lawyers often turn to immediately is the Digital Millennial Copyright Act, to see if whatever the deepfake is, somebody owns a copyright around that, because that's a really successful way. And other celebrities, Kim Kardashian is one of the more famous folks who's been able to use that the DMCA to get a platform to remove that content. And so some celebrities have been doing that, but also the notion that one is a celebrity allows. Aside from that, right, aside from whatever legal rights are attached, when someone is a celebrity, the websites and platforms are quicker to respond with and enforce their terms of service and their content monitoring and moderation policies to put eyes on what is out there, and they're able to pull them down. And so that is what I see celebrities doing. The one that has done it most openly is Scarlett Johansson, has been able to do that. Again, it's not entirely eliminated the deepfakes about her on the internet, but that's something that celebrities are certainly doing, besides sending cease and desist letters and threatening legal action.
So over the last, it was about a year ago, 1,000 leaders and researchers in the tech field signed an open letter urging all of us to hit pause on the development of advanced AI systems. And it was really on the basis that continuing to advance these systems at such a rapid pace poses profound risks to society and humanity. Do you think that pushing pause like this is the right solution? And how far, on the other side, how far is too far when it comes to continuing to develop AI?
Yeah, I'm going to change your question just a little bit. So because although I think that, putting pause is a sound request, because I do agree that there are profound risks that AI poses in a number of fronts, but I'm not actually, and I encourage people to support that, but I don't think that reflects the reality that we currently inhabit, right? That is not, I don't mean to be a doomsayer, but that's not going to happen, right? We're not going to be able to put pause on the development of this technology. And so in my view, really what we need to do is place our efforts on detection, regulation, and education. And I am also someone who is, I won't say that I'm neutral on AI technologies and what we can do with them. I actually think, I'm not negative, but I'm not overly positive. It's a reality we live with. I think we need to figure out how to coexist with AI. And I'm not even sure too far is, I'm not even sure that I can respond to what too far is. I don't know what too far looks like.
Tell us a little more with the brief time we've got left, Dean, about, you said detection, education, and legislation.
Right.
Give us some highlights of what could be done.
Right. In terms of detection, I think that the detection tools are being developed as we speak by private actors and governmental actors. And I think we really need to invest public resources and private resources in continuing to develop those tools. Because if we have tools to detect deepfakes and the presence of AI, or like more broadly AI in our lives, then we have full information about how to make decisions. And they're still relatively crude. So I would encourage more research and development and funding placed there. In terms of regulation, so one of the things that's really interesting is there are a number of federal, the states have done a lot in this space, but there are a number of federal proposals that are pending. The Supreme Court said last year that they weren't going to interfere with, for example, the CDA Section 230, which grants broad immunity to ISP providers and websites and creators, and also gives them flexibility and discretion to enforce or not their terms of service and their content moderation policies. The Supreme Court said that is not unconstitutional. And so really the ball is in the court of congressional and federal policymakers to do something. And one of the areas that I would really, that I feel strongly that we have to have a serious conversation about is the Communication Decency Act, Section 230, that creates that immunity. I think that making a change, reining that in, I don't necessarily think I'd be in favor of repealing it, but I do think we need to amend it. Because I think that we are at a space where the lack of regulation in this area has allowed private bad actors, those in the dark side, to really take advantage in a way that is harming not only celebrities but others others as well. So I think we need to take a look at that. And I have lots of ideas about how to amend CDA 230, which we don't have time for today. But to touch on your last point about education is I think that we need, when folks have studied whether human beings are successful in detecting a deepfake, what they found, there are a few studies out there, but what they found is we're overconfident about our ability to determine what is real versus what is fake. And so we're just not particularly successful. I mean, the percentages are quite huge where people think something's a deep fake and they know and they just get it wrong. And so we need to educate the public about that fact, number one. And then we need to educate the public as we're developing detection tools, what we do know about detection, how to really have a skeptical eye about anything they see, because we're no longer in this space of seeing is believing on the internet. And so really having a public an open conversation, which can be led by celebrities, they're perfectly positioned to do this more than anyone else. I mean, I've for a long time have wanted Taylor Swift and her Swifties to get out there and be in front of it. So I think those are the key ways that we have to move forward.
Last question. We've talked a lot about celebrities and what they're doing because they're different, right? Because there are certain laws and protections that protect them, like right of publicity, for example, is another line of laws that are more state in basis. But what should we do if we as non-celebrities find that there are either deep fakes out there of ourselves or of people that we know who may also be non-celebrities?
Right. So great question. There's a couple of things that can be done. The first thing that I would do is I would reach out to the websites where these deep fakes appear and ask them to enforce their to deplatform or take it off. That should be done immediately. In the meantime, I would also say I would then put myself out there to point out this is a deep fake, right? You know, the best response to bad actors is people taking place, you know, taking their space in the public square and saying, this is not me. So we do that. And then the other thing I would do is to the extent you live in a state with a really robust law that either criminalizes this conduct or has broadened their definition of the right of publicity and appropriation of likeness to extend beyond commercial use, I would then seek out, you know, counsel where I could to help me to protect myself in that way.
Professor Rebecca Delfino, thank you so much for joining us. And by the way, we're all celebrities here, Tina. Come on, everyone on this call is a celebrity. You know,
wonderful.
Don't be too presumptuous, Ryan.
Yeah.
And Burroughs and Burroughs actually AI.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
We're back on Legal Face-Off. Well, heard in the newsroom this week, we're just 3 weeks ago from 3 weeks to go, rather, until the NFL preseason. Some are ready. I'm definitely not. But the off the field, the NFL is shelling out some big bucks after losing an antitrust lawsuit. To talk about it, we're joined by Nellie Drew, professor of practice in sports law, director of University of Buffalo Center for the Advancement of Sport. Professor Drew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Professor, this week, Roger Goodell said, not surprisingly, that he disagreed with this ruling. There is some intimation that the league might have trouble maintaining its credit rating, which is like mind-blowing given how lucrative and longstanding a valuable brand the NFL is. But you said that this decision was unprecedented, in which the U.S. District Court ruled that the NFL had to pay more than $4.7 billion, that's billion with a B, in damages after finding that the NFL violated antitrust laws in distributing out-of-market Sunday afternoon games on the premium subscription known as Sunday Ticket. Why is it unprecedented?
Just the sheer size of it is breathtaking.
Explain that. We've never seen a product like this being dealt with in this fashion, right?
Yeah, it's just that, you know, the complexity of an antitrust lawsuit by definition is so hard to wrap your mind around. Getting one to trial is a vast undertaking. And so very few actually make it this far. getting to trial and then getting to a jury verdict, and a jury verdict in numbers that are basically mind-blowing, right? There's so many parts to this very, very unusual situation that, you know, everything had to fall just right for us to get to where we are right now today.
It's a rather complicated case, but as I understand it, this goes back to 2015, where subscribers for the Sunday Ticket sued the NFL, saying that in order to get out-of-market games, you had to buy the package, but these were at inflated prices and basically prices that were fixed. Is that basically the allegation?
Yeah. So if you think about it in terms of you as a consumer having to buy a much larger package of something than what you really want. There's a great movie of Father of the Bride, some of you may recall, where the father figure kind of loses his marbles during his daughter's wedding preparations and gets upset because he has to buy more hot dogs than he needs, more hot dog rolls than he needs for the number of hot dogs in the package. That's kind of what we're talking about here. Okay.
So, Professor, given the complexities of an antitrust case and the, you know, and the expense, et cetera, of defending one, why would the NFL let this go to trial?
That is a question that I can't answer, and I have been struggling mightily to parse through that for quite a while now. You know, the NFL is capable of and does hire the best antitrust counsel in the world, and they're intimately involved in every move the NFL makes. Why you would choose to go forward rather than settle, which, by the way, historically has been the NFL's, you know, strategy of choice, right, for decades. I honestly can't tell you. It didn't look like that good a case to me. Maybe it was that they thought, again, you know, it's such a complex thing. And as I just said previously, everything had to go just exactly right for this verdict to come out the way it did.
Professor, I just going back to the, you know, what was proven here, you know, we're seeing similar, we've covered similar allegations with premium consumer goods. For example, there's allegations that in order to get, you know, these Birkins or these very expensive handbags or purses, you have to buy, you know, some other products to get yourself in the position to buy a $15,000 or $20,000 bag, right? But, you know, isn't the argument against that and what the NFL said is that, you know, this is a premium product. There's only so many NFL players, there's only so many teams on the planet, and we have the right, as do producers of premium, you know, purses, have the right to make you pay for that, right? I mean, isn't that at the end of the day what is being alleged here?
They are casting the argument in that way. That's correct. Having said that, however, I don't know how familiar you are with the Sports Broadcasting Act. That was part of the NFL's defense as well. Sports Broadcasting Act was passed in 1961 to allow professional sports leagues to package all of their media rights and sell them as a group. So in other words, you know, as we've seen, like the NFL has its national broadcasts of football games, right? But the part about that the NFL is glossing over is that the act specifically defined the exemption only for over-the-air television, not cable, not subscription. And that's what this is in its essence, right, is a subscription package. So the NFL is mischaracterizing in its defense that the Sports Broadcasting Act provides it a larger exemption than it actually has. And historically, we know that antitrust exemptions, by definition, have been very, very strictly construed by the courts. It's a very small carve-out meant to be within the confines of exactly as it's drawn, not interpreted to be more broad than that.
Issues in this case, do you think would be ripe for appeal here? I think we can assume there's going to be an appeal filed. So what do you think would be the basis for an appeal?
Well, first, I should say that the NFL in the last, oh, I'd say 24 hours or so, has indicated that posting the recorded bond for an appeal would be problematic. I think I can't remember what the exact language was, but essentially they're concerned about it. They are getting perhaps cold feet about doing so because it's a lot of money. Having said that, I'm not sure you can let this judgment sit, right? So first of all, they're moving for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. They're filing a motion with the trial judge saying essentially that there were mistakes made, that the jury confused overcharging with discounting, that the formula that was used to determine damages was actually a formula that the plaintiff's attorneys never even proposed. There's a couple of the arguments they used. In addition to that, they're saying that even if the judgment goes forward, the judge has to first apportion the damages among the various plaintiffs. So, for example, you know, this person who paid this amount for Sunday Ticket over, you know, 4 years would receive more than this person who paid for Sunday Ticket over 1 year. You understand the differentiation there. So they've got a bunch of different aspects to that. And finally, they're saying that before anything can be finalized, the judge needs to determine what changes he would have to make the Sunday ticket package to make it essentially legal.
Professor, you've said that, again, this has wide-ranging tentacles, implications. Lots of other sports leagues have products that are similar to NFL Sunday Ticket. How do you expect them to react?
Well, you've got NHL Center Ice, which is very much like the Sunday Ticket, and then you've got MLB's Extra Innings. MLB has the little caveat of having, which you're probably familiar with, the baseball antitrust exemption. So at least for the moment, you know, it would appear that the baseball antitrust exemption would still apply and cover MLB. The NHL is probably watching this very, very carefully.
As we were speaking, I just want you guys to know, breaking NFL news, Patrick Mahomes and his wife are expecting a third child. So there you go.
Straight well, the congratulations news. To them. Although as a Bills fan and a Josh Allen devotee, My allegiance lies elsewhere.
I feel you, especially after the last couple seasons. Professor Dellinger, yeah. Thank you so much. Appreciate you joining us.
No problem. Glad to do it.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Tina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. Well, Oklahoma Superintendent of Public Instruction Ryan Walters is making it mandatory to teach elements of the Bible in public schools. You know that's going to be challenging in court. One of the people who is challenging that is Rachel Lazar, the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Ms. Lazar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Well, Rachel, as Ryan mentioned, the Oklahoma Superintendent of Public Instruction, Ryan Walters, has issued a directive recently that will require Oklahoma public schools to assimilate the Bible into the curriculum across multiple grade levels. Tell us more about this requirement and what gives Walters the authority to issue this edict.
So, and I want to just correct the record really quickly. We have not yet sued here. We have sued to challenge the nation's first religious public charter school, also happening in Oklahoma, although Attorney General Drummond's lawsuit put a stop to that for now. The Oklahoma State Supreme Court ruled against it. We have a parallel lawsuit there. Here, we are monitoring very closely. We are a watchdog group, and we're ready to step in and take action to protect the religious freedom of parents and students throughout the state. Let's talk about this Bible mandate, which is a little hazy and vague at this point, right? So his memo, filled with legalese, clearly edited by his lawyers, said one thing, trying to root it in this sort of historical history and tradition. You can teach about the history of our country. We can talk about that. But what he said when he issued the mandate was these classrooms have to have Bibles in them and teachers have to teach from them, right? So that is problematic. That is asking all families and students to submit to sort of one form of religion, right? And that may not be the parents, what the parents want to teach their kids. Speaking of parents' rights, I'm a parent. I don't know if you all are. That would really bother me as a parent, right? And I send my kids to public school. And so it's a violation of both church-state separation and religious freedom. Both, you know, because people in Oklahoma, excuse me, come from a variety of different backgrounds, religious backgrounds, different types of Christianity, other Abrahamic religions, non-Abrahamic religions, non-religious folk. And what our country tells us, both federally and also Oklahoma, right? And in Oklahoma's great constitution, is that we are all promised religious freedom equally, right? And that we won't be treated unequally by our government. There won't be separate classes based on what we believe or what our kids believe. And kids, I mean, I feel very mama bearish in this space as a mother. I mean, even the Supreme Court has been very sensitive, in particular to the religious freedom of school children, because number one, they're captive in schools, right? They got to go. They should go. And number two, they're impressionable. Don't you remember, like, what your teacher said to you was like the law, you know? And it was like, your teachers meant a lot. And if they made you feel bad or like second class, that was a really big deal. And it also created an atmosphere where students can make other students feel like they're part of an out group. And, you know, no one wants kids to feel ostracized or even bullied based on their religious beliefs. So what we're fighting for here is the religious freedom of parents and students, and that our public schools remain inclusive places that are welcoming to all of our children, regardless of what their family's belief system is.
So this is part of a larger movement, some are calling Christian nationalism. We covered last podcast the recent decision allowing the Ten Commandments to be displayed in a school. What's the status of this movement? And it seems like, to me, I agree with you, it's a bit of a troubling dynamic that's happening, not just in your state, but in many others.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And let's just talk about this concept of Christian nationalism for a moment, because it's a little delicate, right? And the one thing that I want to say about it first is it's not Christianity. It's just not. It's a political ideology that is rooted in the belief that America was created for European Christians and that our laws and policies and preference should reflect that. You know, that's what this movement is looking for in America, this continued power and privilege for a select few. And it's antithetical to who we are as a nation, because what we promise is equality, you know, no matter what the color of our skin is, no matter what our belief system is, right? That's the promise that we're trying to live up to. Religious freedom is a promise that's in our DNA. You know, it's in our DNA. And it's in our DNA as a nation. And the reality is no one, right? No matter, even if you're in the group that's looking for privilege, no one should want that promise to go away, because then none of us are safe in any community, because we don't know what the religious minority might be and who's going to oppress who, right? That's one thing. And number two, America stops being America without it. Like, it's that foundational. It's the first 16 words of our First Amendment of our Constitution. Right. And so that's really dangerous. You asked, what is the state of things? Not good. You know, like on a scale of 1 to 10, it's in like the bottom of the scale right now. And that's because, you know, we've got from, you know, Texas to West Virginia, you know, from Florida to Idaho, we've got laws that are, you know, forcing one form of religion into our public schools. We've got 10 commandment mandates in Louisiana. We've got laws in Idaho and Kentucky that would allow teachers and coaches to pray with students alongside of students. We've got these laws that would allow public schools to replace certified school counselors with chaplains. And those have been passed in three states now. We've got in West Virginia, a law that now sort of clears the path for teachers in science to teach creationism to students. So, and that's just in the realm, by the way, of public schools, right? Because we can look bigger, because abortion bans are also imposing one narrow religious belief on all of us, right? Rather than leaving it up to our own belief systems to make our own decisions I'm a woman, you know, about our own bodies according to our own set of beliefs, right? And they're taking that away from us. So, you know, that's another example of this Christian nationalist movement. And I would give as a third example, real attacks, cruel attacks on the LGBTQ community, and that have been very damaging with really terrible results. And in you know, Oklahoma, just the, you know, the tragic death of this non-binary teenager, Nex Benedict, who, you know, was bullied and died a few days later in their school. You know, so we've got a really big problem right now. And it's stemming, I think, quite honestly, to be optimistic for a minute, from a lot of the recent progress that our country has made. But it's very real right now. We've got Supreme Court justices and the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives flying or having flown the Christian nationalist appeal to heaven flag. So we've got, you know, we've got problems, and it's time for a national recommitment to church-state separation to protect religious freedom before it's too late.
Thank you very much, Rachel Lazar, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, it's time for the legal grab bag. We have the pleasure of being joined by Corey Teusch, Chief Operating Officer at S1 Medical. And we've got the founder and CEO of Ion PT Network, Joe Noel. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
As tradition here, 2024 on Legal Face-Off, we open up the grab bag. And the first thing on the top of the bag is Trump Watch. Rich, you want to talk immunity, vice president, next week's RNC. Where do you want to take this discussion today?
Well, I mean, Trump's having a remarkable run of luck here with his legal problems. We covered earlier in the show the immunity case. And the immunity case, you know, his I think the next day, his lawyers filed a motion to dismiss the case because he's arguing that the acts for which he was convicted are now subject to this new immunity law that allows a president a lot of leeway to do things that were previously illegal. So both in the New York case and in the Fulton County, Georgia case, Trump is arguing that what he did were official acts, part of his job, and that he is immune from prosecution under the new standards set forth by the Roberts majority. You know, we all know that already he secured a victory just in terms of the timing of it, because as Kim, Professor Whaley, very articulately set forth, there's just no way that the New York case or any of the cases, even the January 6th case, will make its way through the system and through appeals in time for the November election. So in many ways, even if Trump is able, or the prosecution in the January 6th case, I should say, is able to overcome this new standard, it's unlikely that it'll happen before November. And then if Trump wins, he's going to disband the case entirely.
I agree, Rich. I mean, there are several layers of issues here as a result of this decision. There's obviously the decision itself, and then there's also the timeline, and then there's also the ambiguity with respect to what the gray zone is with respect to this new standard with immunity, right? So there's certain things that clearly fall within the immunity, like the official acts, but there's this gray zone. And each court is going to have to figure out, each court that has a case pending where this immunity may be triggered, has to sort of figure out what falls within it, what falls outside of it. And as we all know, that ambiguity leads to delay, and delay is definitely going to be in Trump's favor in this particular situation with the November election.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a stretch, Joe, to argue that paying a prostitute hush money, or a porn star, I should say, hush money, as a candidate is an official act by a president. But as Tina mentioned, and as our earlier guest mentioned, the language of the decision is fairly broad and, you know, falls as a presumption in favor of the office holder.
Well, I'm going to speak for the public, both Corey and I. I'm glad she said, you know, not being an attorney, we're going to dispense some crazy, wicked legal advice here. I want to know, and Tina, you don't know me, so forgive me if I completely push this train off the track, but when we discuss official acts, can we revisit Clinton v. Lewinsky? Is that possible?
Why not?
Nobody got that. Sorry, Rich.
Oh, I get
it. I'm just trying to determine what's an official act and what's not. But your timeline is actually correct. How can something that took place before he became president? I mean, I'm Joe Citizen. I'm Joe Public. I don't understand how this decision with any sort of immunity granted a president during his tenure as sitting president, how can that predate that? I mean, I would love to be president. Does that mean I have a green card, a get out of jail free card going forward if I actually became president?
Right.
We're technically in day four of the Alec Baldwin involuntary manslaughter trial in New Mexico for that shooting on the set of the movie Rust. Tina, you've been following this for us.
So this is something that we've been following here on Legal Face-Off ever since, you know, it was nearly 3 years ago now that that shooting happened on the set. Alec Baldwin's being tried now for, I think it's involuntary manslaughter. But, you know, what's interesting is, unfortunately, so this, he was indicted by the grand jury a few months ago. The prosecutors had previously dropped the charge. He pled not guilty. He has maintained the whole time that he did not pull the trigger on the firearm on the set that unfortunately fired a live round, leaving the film cinematographer Helena Hutchins dead, the director Joel Souza injured. We've been following this all very closely. His manslaughter trial began this week. Opening statements were on Wednesday. Prosecutors have contended that he behaved recklessly when and he had violated the cardinal rules of firearm safety while he was on the set. And obviously his attorneys claim that he did not commit any crime. The most critical issue was, in their minds, how the live bullet got on the set. And as we know, Hannah Gutierrez, who is the armorer, was already convicted of involuntary manslaughter in March. And so Alec Baldwin's defense is really that the real issue here has already been addressed. So there have already been a number of witnesses that have appeared, including a crime scene technician who talked about the evidence that's been collected. The defense is really that Baldwin was unable to have the gun tested, that there was damage done to the gun during the firearms testing by the FBI. What's really super interesting, though, is that we're several days into the case, and Hannah Gutierrez was actually set to testify today. And the headline that's broken since we've been recording this show, actually, is that the judge in the case has had the jurors go home for the weekend because apparently Alec Baldwin's lawyers have filed a motion to dismiss in the case on the basis that the state failed to turn over a batch of bullets to the defense. And they claim it's one of any number of missteps that has happened that they claim has prejudiced Alec Baldwin. So this is clearly a breaking story, Rich. It's going to be interesting to see what the judge does with this motion. But short of that, I mean, I think that if the decision is not in Alec Baldwin's favor on this motion to dismiss, we're going to see this go to the end and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it should be a couple of weeks. The armorer is serving 18 months in jail for her role. We heard today from the seller of the gun saying there's no way that this bullet would have been dislodged short of pulling the trigger. Alec Baldwin says he didn't pull the trigger. He also says he wasn't responsible. Very importantly, was responsible for, you know, the bullet being in the chamber. Very importantly, early on, he won a motion so that the jury will not hear evidence that he was a producer, only an actor. As a producer, perhaps the jury would find that he was responsible for everything on set, including the, you know, the gun. But Corey, do you think the jury is able to, you know, put their feelings of Alec Baldwin aside whenever there's a celebrity involved? You always wonder how the jury feels, if that favors celebrity or maybe doesn't favor them. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is tough. And I think his past makes this a little bit tough, too. He's beloved, but has also had negative headlines in the past. You know, the fact that he's a star, but the producer plus the actor, it's layered on multiple levels, if you look at it from a risk perspective. I think what was also interesting was how the jury shook out men versus women. I'm not sure that landed in his favor either. So I do think the jury is going to have a tough time separating him from the allegations to being a superstar. So it'll be really interesting how this plays out and how the jury reacts to what they are allowed to know versus not allowed to know as well.
So Alec Baldwin and his family of like, 27 kids or something, they're also at night walking around Santa Fe, they're shopping. They're also filming a reality show that they recently sold. Do you think that that's purposeful, that he's trying to portray himself as a family man? He was seen yesterday pushing the baby carriage while his wife and kids were up front.
I think they have to do that. I think they have to humanize him and also take away some of that star celebrity. So if they're forced to make a decision, what they see is a guy in front of them, the weight of the gun with a fake bullet versus a real bullet, it's not going to be different. I mean, this was, a tragic accident. I think that's the test. That's the position that they'll take, certainly.
Well, this is the second time in 2 weeks Baldwin's team has filed a motion to dismiss. Obviously, the first one did not work out for him. We've got an icky story out of Texas where a megachurch pastor is accused of sexually abusing a 12-year-old girl. And Rich, his lawyer, is saying what?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. The lawyer, the pastor's, first of all, name is Robert Morris. He admitted to inappropriate sexual contact with a 12-year-old girl who's now an adult. His lawyer wrote a letter back in 2007 that said, I'm going to read the words. It was your client, by the way, this lawyer's name is J. Shelby Sharp. He wrote, it was your client who initiated inappropriate behavior by coming into my client's bedroom and getting in bed with him, which my client should not have allowed to happen. It's kind of like saying, Tina, that Elena Hutchins, the cinematographer, was responsible because she got in the way of the bullet, right? And she died as a result. I mean, it's kind of shocking to blame a 12-year-old who has been assaulted, sexually assaulted by a pastor. Since this letter was disclosed, Sharp said he didn't remember writing it, and this is my favorite part, doesn't have the time to read it now. Okay. Not a great response. I mean, the letter is not the greatest letter I've ever read by a lawyer, but his response doesn't portray himself in the greatest light, I think.
Well, and he absolutely knows that that's the case, right? I mean, the word preposterous keeps coming to mind the more and more I think about this particular situation. And that is the response of somebody who knows that what they did was completely wrong and completely inappropriate. And that is their best effort to deflect any conversation about something that is just completely preposterous.
I mean, Joe, there's victim shaming. I mean, it's no surprise that whenever there's an allegation of sexual abuse or rape, it's a frequent tactic to go after the accuser. We get that. But a 12-year-old is responsible because she went in the room. I mean, geez, that's rough.
Well, I mean, it's in keeping with the comment that, the woman that got raped, she shouldn't have worn that outfit. I mean, certainly. So I can tell you this, that as a physical therapist, treating a broken arm was very black and white with respect to what we do. And a physical therapist and I would probably take the same path to, rehab that person. The law invites some gray area and some attorneys just take that to an extreme. Reading these comments, that's what it looks like. So I'm grateful that my career is a little bit easier to navigate, if you will.
Well, so the Chicago Cubs have filed a federal lawsuit against those rooftop owners across the street. Number one, I don't know why we have two Phillies fans on to talk about this. And number two, Tina, I'm actually shocked that it's taken this long for this lawsuit to happen.
So there is a long history here that I will try to make as pithy as possible. As many Chicagoans know, the dispute between the Cubs and rooftop owners around Wrigley Field started many years ago, with the parties going to court a number of times to litigate whether the rooftop owners have a right to generate profits from Wrigley Field events that can be viewed from those rooftops. And deals were struck about 20 years ago where the owners of those rooftops agreed to share a percentage of their revenue, 17% of their revenue from the actual sales of seats, and 11% of billboard revenue was shared with the Cubs. And since that time, the Cubs have bought many of those properties, and those that remain as not being owned by the Cubs, those deals have expired. And so negotiations started up again with those remaining rooftop owners, and the negotiations with Wrigley View Rooftop hit a snag in the spring with reports that the Cubs are now requesting 30% of rooftop seating revenue and 50% of billboard revenue being the main block in terms of negotiations. And so the Cubs and Wrigley rooftop, after reaching this impasse, led to the Cubs filing suit a few days ago, alleging unlicensed sales, intellectual property theft, misappropriation, unjust enrichment, and unfair competition. They're also accusing Wrigley View rooftop of falsely advertising that the Cubs are endorsing their sale of the seats. And there's also a claim of trademark infringement relating to that false endorsement with respect to use of the Cubs' trademarks. So much of the complaint deals with what it dealt with many years ago, which is really the free rider problem. The Cubs are saying that they're investing tens of millions of dollars in talent and in the business of running the team, and that the defendant is disrupting their ability to recoup their investment, and that they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars annually, all without incurring any costs to actually produce the end product that is the draw for the sale of those tickets. In prior litigation and in this litigation here, the expectation is that the rooftop owners are going to argue that there really is nothing wrong with having people come and watch a live performance from an adjacent location, and that their property rights actually enable them to erect seating from their properties. I mean, Rich, we saw this many years ago, obviously, when the Cubs installed the lights in Wrigley Field many years ago. That's when all of this really started brewing. I think ultimately there's probably going to be a settlement here, particularly against the backdrop of the history with this. But who knows? It's an interesting case.
When the Cubs did their renovations a few years ago, they put a hole in the fence for the general public to walk up and watch the game. Doesn't that, if you're on the jury, let's say this case goes to trial, don't you argue that where would your privacy rights be if you're allowing the general public to consume this product that you're now arguing is so valuable and you require money for it? I mean, that kind of shoots that argument down, number one. Number two, I mean, the Cubs previously agree to give up this product for money, right? So it's hard for the Cubs to argue that this is this absolute right that shouldn't be, given away for free. They already negotiated that away. Now it's just a question of how much money is involved. They want more money. I get it. It's a valuable product. We just talked to another guest about the value of the NFL. MLB, you know, is worth billions and billions of dollars. Why give it away for free? I get it. Listen, if you go to a if you pull up to a parking lot at the, you know, at Soldier Field and listen to the Rolling Stones, are they charging you for that? You know, we just passed July 4th. If you're watching fireworks from your balcony, do you expect to get a bill from the city because you consume their product? You know, I get the Cubs argument. It's a unique situation that's pretty unique to Chicago. There's not many other ballparks where you could watch it from a private residence and actually see a pretty good, you know, pretty good view. So, they'll negotiate this down. This isn't going to go to a jury. I think it'll just be a question of how much more money the rooftops are going to give up to the Cubs. Corey, you love baseball. You go to a lot of games. Who do you side with here? Rooftop owners or Cubs?
Well, I mean, if it takes the Cubs down, I might have to go with the rooftop owners just so we can, you know, get a few more wins in our bucket. But I got to go with the rooftop owners here because I just think it's such a nostalgic spot in Chicago that's probably bringing in money to the city for people visiting out of town. I would love to come in and sit on one of those rooftops and just catch a game from that perspective. I get the, you know, endorsing a relationship with the Cubs that may not be there. That to me, I think is probably crossing the line a little bit, but I'm rooting for the rooftop here. I think it's amazing. I think it brings a new perspective to baseball.
Joe, interestingly, one of the historic buildings behind the stadium that Corey just referenced, the one that has the famous, Ryan knows this, the Go Cubs in Latin, that building is now going to be taken down and made apartments because it's literally behind the scoreboard that's relatively new. You can't see anything. So the value of that building from a spectator's perspective is now gone. But where do you come down on this?
Well, I'm with Corey. I actually side with the building owners at this point. I'm a University of Georgia grad, and we used to have a bridge that ran on the southwest side of Sanford Stadium, which used to be open. So if you couldn't get a ticket to the football game, you just stood on the bridge and you watched the game. And the university got wise then and said, we're going to just make our stadium bigger, I think probably to compete with the other, you know, mega stadiums in the SEC. But then I also think about the hotel that sits right behind center field in Baltimore. If you've ever been to, what's the name of that? Camden Yards, right? Camden. You can actually stay at the Westin, I think, and actually watch the game from your room. I don't think you get charged for it. So I'm with the building owners at this point.
You might be thinking of Blue Jays Stadium.
There's one in Camden Yards also. Oh, okay. You can see it straight from there.
Yeah, the one
you can catch slivers of the game from the hotel across the street from Wrigley too. So does that now become a possible contention here? Maybe only one foul ball, but it's there.
Yeah.
As a Cubs fan, I'm for whatever gets us closer to getting Juan Soto. That's all it takes. A teenage carjacking suspect was shot outside of a Supreme Court justice's home this week. A really bizarre story. Rich, you tossed this one in the bag for us.
When you choose to carjack a vehicle, here's a little tip. Don't pick the one that is inhabited by a federal marshal who is tasked with protecting with heavy firearms one of the nine most important people in the country. Yeah, Sotomayor's home was the area where this happened last Friday around 1:17 a.m. An 18-year-old approached this minivan, knocked on the window with his gun, and was met with a barrage of gunfire, struck him in the mouth, in the jaw, non-life-threatening injuries, but a second deputy also opened fire. So choose wisely, my friends, when you're carjacking, I guess.
Wow. Crazy. What's unclear to me, Rich, is whether this person knew that Sotomayor was living there. What's also amazing to me is that this person didn't die. I mean, he got bullets to part of his head. I mean, and it sounds like more than one. So it's remarkable to me that they were not life-threatening injuries.
Yeah. Joe, I'm thinking of getting what's that thing you put on your wheel? The claw?
The club.
The club.
Okay.
I've seen a few clubs lately. I don't know if the club would have dissuaded this would-be carjacker, but
one of my billers actually has a club and she puts it on her Dodge Ram pickup truck, which I found somewhat amusing. There's also a show on Netflix right now called The Visitor or something. Where one of the characters is actually putting a club on a kind of a small Volkswagen rental in Ireland, which, again, is just comical. So, well, your point's well taken. I mean, the guy with the bigger gun typically wins. And I think when he knocked on the window with his 22 or whatever it was and the Secret Service opened fire, like Teen, I'm surprised he didn't pass away.
Love the fact that it was a minivan. The feds are driving a minivan because, you know, they want protection, but also comfort. They want to have a lot of cup holders.
Do you think the fact that they were wearing shirts that said Secret Service deputy was to deter people from coming closer to the vehicle, or perhaps something that the carjacker maybe should have noticed as he was approaching?
Polo shirts, by the way. They sound very weather appropriate.
Right?
Yeah, who knows?
Who designed that iconic Nirvana smiley face logo? Was it Kurt Cobain? Was it someone else? Is this settled, Tina?
Well, Ryan, Nirvana's no stranger to litigation. We've covered here on Legal Face-Off over the past couple of years how the baby who was on the picture of their iconic Nevermind album sued the band, claiming it was sexual exploitation and a violation of child pornography laws. So now Nirvana has settled another case, this time in California, involving Marc Jacobs and a former record company employee in a five-year dispute over Nirvana's smiley face logo. This time Nirvana was the plaintiff. Back in 2018, they accused Marc Jacobs of stealing that smiley face. I've actually taken a look at the logos, did a side-by-side, and noticed that the Marc Jacobs version of that smiley face that they were using on a line of apparel look just like the Nirvana version, with the exception that the two eyes in the Nirvana version, the two X's, were replaced by the letters M and J. So Nirvana claims Kurt Cobain created that logo, that they've ended up plastering on a lot of merchandising over the years and have made them a lot of money over. Marc Jacobs claimed that the band wasn't able to rebut evidence that they presented that Kurt Cobain didn't create it. And the record company employee who was originally involved in the litigation claims he created it, but that he didn't create it within the scope of his employment, and that's why he owns it. There ended up being some controversy, and the judge ended up locking out that employee from the litigation, saying that even if he had drawn the logo, it was probably probably owned by the record company. But in any event, it doesn't matter anymore, Rich, because there's been a settlement here. But, you know, it's interesting because when you do that side by side, you do see that they are essentially identical. And it's hard to believe that that Marc Jacobs would have come up with it independently. It looks almost like a five-year-old drew it, but it's very original in its five-year-old rendition.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so, Corey, you guys have some thoughts about this one?
Ladies first.
This one just struck me as kind of a huh. It's such an old logo. You know, how do you prove that far back? Or do people care about copyright infringement that far back? You know, and what's the basis for Nirvana to stand up against? What's the evidence? What do they have? I think that Marc Jacobs to take two eyes and replace them with initials is genius because everybody knows the logo. That's going to entice purchasing and market awareness just alone from the longevity from Nirvana. So I'm interested to know, Tina, what the settlement was and what prevailed here.
What's interesting is that I don't think that they've disclosed the terms of settlement. I think that the court's giving the party several weeks to submit further information about the settlement. I think they've just agreed to stay whatever deadlines there are in the litigation now pending the settlement.
I remember I was married to a graphic designer, and she's very, very talented. And when she started doing logos, she had to be very cognizant of what was in the space already. And I'm not sure if it's copyright infringement or whatever, but I think there were something like 13 different elements that had to be changed or something so that you could not be sued for copyright infringement. So if only two characters were changed, I would lean towards Nirvana saying almost closed, closed case, if you will. So not surprised they settled just to get out of the news. I am shocked that the little baby filed for sexual harassment. I think that's probably genius or wrong. I'm not sure which, but the line between the two is probably not that thin, right?
I'm interested in knowing who Nirvana is at this point with Kurt gone and, you know, everyone kind of breaking off and doing their own thing. I don't think Courtney Love's in charge of all this stuff, but I don't know.
I wonder if Yoko owns it.
It's possible.
Well, that's why the logo matters.
I've never heard the phrase before. Are those hamsters in your pants? But Rich, I guess we can now say that in Ohio of all places.
Yeah. You have been covering Richard Gere's career long enough, Ryan Burrow. But there was a break-in in Columbus at a pet shop. And in addition to letting a bunch of animals go free, when the police caught up with the perpetrator, whose name, by the way, can't make this up, Matthew Pancake, when they caught up with Mr. Pancake, they discovered that there were four gerbils in his pants. According to the body cam footage that we saw, they said, oh, God, there's a gerbil in there. What the heck? Multiple gerbils recovered. I'm not sure, Tina, if there's a like official police number for that, you know, like they have. But this guy was on a mission to put small animals in his trousers. Mission success, I guess. Mission accomplished.
Yeah, I don't know if that was really the reasoning behind doing this breaking and entering sort of thing, or if he was trying to use some sort of animal activist who's trying to free animals from being, from profits being garnered from their sale or what the story was. But, to the extent he was looking to get some animals like, you know, cats and dogs and whoever else was released, there are plenty of shelters where he could get these for free if what he was looking for was a furry friend.
All right. Well, let's learn a little more about our guest by ending our podcast with how we end everything. We'll go around the horn. And we talked about Nirvana, Kurt Cobain, who Ryan mentioned is no longer with us. Why don't you name us, everyone, your favorite dead musician, your favorite musician who is no longer with us, but whose music perhaps you still enjoy. Corey, would you like to start us off with the answer to that question?
I got to say a quick Jimmy Buffett.
Jimmy Buffett, recently deceased. Very good. Ryan Burrow.
I mean, I would go Nirvana, but I guess Bradley Knoll would be good from Sublime.
Okay. By the way, there's no shortage of candidates. Many of these musicians, unfortunately, pass away very early. Joe Noel, who is your favorite deceased artist?
I got to go with Prince.
Prince is a great one. Tina?
John Lennon.
John Lennon. That's a good one. Lisa, do you have any for us?
I like Michael Hutchins.
Oh.
Another great choice.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Died in a kind of unique way. Autoerotic asphyxiation.
Lead singer of NXS, right?
Yeah. Sure,
absolutely.
He's been gone since 97, I think. I remember he died. I'm a huge NXS fan. I remember the day he died very well.
Me too.
My runner-up would be Elvis, if I'm allowed to.
I'd go Chris Cornell.
I was going to say, darn, because I always think of Chris Cornell when we talk about Michael Hutchins.
Chester Bennington, that's a good one.
Michael Jackson.
No.
Well, Michael Jackson brings to mind the gerbils, though, so I think.
Yeah, exactly. It all comes full circle.
Whitney Houston, great one.
Rich, who's yours?
Mine is Gord Downie from the Tragically Hip, who you all know, right? Canadian.
Nope. I didn't know that as a Canadian, 30% of the music that is on Canadian radio has to be from Canadian artists. Is that still true today?
And television, absolutely. It's a federal Canadian content rule. Also in the CFL, by the way.
Rich, I'm surprised you didn't mention Gordon Lightfoot.
I have a whole list of Canadians named Gordon who have died. Canadian musicians named Gordon for 300.
You still got a lot of living ones. Nickelback, Alanis Morissette. You got a lot.
Some would say too many.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Joe and Corey. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face Off on WGN. Special thanks to Kimberly Whaley, constitutional law expert and professor of law at the University of Baltimore, Rebecca Delfino, Loyola Marymount University professor of law. Rachel Lazar, the president and CEO at Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Also, you can get more information on her at AU.org. We also had professor of practice in law and director at the UB Center for the Advancement of Sport, Helen Nelly Drew. Also, big shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lundkoff, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lundkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...